Hello and welcome to the podcast, What We Teach Our Children. I'm Kim Clyden. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent and empowered children? And they say it takes a village, or what we might call today a community. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. We're surrounded though by people who can support us, your family, friends and professionals, who all play an influential role in shaping our children. Children are our future, and the very existence of the human race depends on what we teach them. Imagine if your parents, teachers, relatives, or carers told you another story. Your life story would be completely different. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. This podcast is about everyone who plays a role in that story at every level of society. How can we support our children to develop emotional intelligence, or the ability to be aware of, control, and express their feelings judiciously and with empathy? In a previous episode, we spoke with Andrea Canaris about the importance of connection and touch from a neuroscience perspective as social beings. Teacher Carrie Sutton also helped us understand that a child's behaviour may be just the tip of an emotional iceberg. Coach, counsellor and facilitator Rowena Hardy understands that children become aware of their surroundings in the womb and the basis of establishing open communication through developmental stages begins with security and trust. First of all, I'd like to welcome you to What We Teach Our Children. Just as a full disclosure, we know each other personally and I've worked with you on a professional development. What is it about working with people through developmental challenges that you are passionate about?
It's a great question, Kim. It's something that I came to rather than that I chose for myself. And it really came off the back of recognizing that so many people struggle with things. And it can be a small thing, it can be a large thing, it could be a multiple, very complex set of things. But it often appeared that there was no simple way for them to get through it. And therefore, when I was doing more work about coaching, counselling, that kind of more behavioural aspects of just talking to people, I recognised there was a huge shift when people could just talk about what was troubling them. And I think that's what kind of really ignited it for me, is the power of offering people space in a non-judgmental setting and totally confidential. And that makes a real difference, because sometimes some people have nobody to talk to. And so for me, it was just offering that opportunity and the power of that.
How have you found that useful in your own life?
Definitely. Although I probably would describe myself as very introspective, I have used people and approached people in the past when you just need to kind of talk things through that don't really make any sense to yourself. And when you talk them through, somebody can kind of unravel it for you. And it really seems to be helpful that things you might have been concerned about, worried about, or just couldn't make any sense of, somebody else can see it from a very objective standpoint and help you understand it, or at least maybe give the opportunity to see a different perspective.
Who have you predominantly worked with over the course of your career?
A huge range of people. The youngest I've worked with has been 7. People into their 80s, but in a more corporate sense then, huge organisations, entrepreneurs, small business, local government, a huge variation, and male, female, all sorts of different challenges. We've never, as a company, myself, I've never really said, I do this and I stick to that. I will accept and work with anybody who wants to work with me and however they found me.
You mentioned you've spoken to someone or coached someone as young as 7 years old. Mm. How would a 7-year-old find their way into your practice, and what sort of assistance were you offering?
It's often through the parents who either worked with me or it's been suggested to them. They come and have a chat with me. And it's interesting. It isn't really a coaching situation with a 7-year-old. It's just having a conversation. Find out where they're at. Use the language that they seem to be comfortable with or okay with. And that's true of anybody actually meeting them where they're at, but with 7-year-olds particularly. But you'd be amazed at how much they'll take on. And I can draw some really simple diagrams on a whiteboard for them, nice and visual. And I go, so tell me how this, I'll describe this. You tell me how this is impacting you. And they know immediately. And that particular graphic talks about emotions and how emotions are a choice. And often with children that age, it's either that they can't express their emotions or they're bringing their emotions inappropriately. And it's very simple, and I'm not a specialist in that area, but I think it's often that we might misunderstand that children will grasp more than we might give them credit for.
I had a researcher recently explain to me that behaviours are often a tip of an iceberg, that underneath there is probably something emotional that children aren't dealing with as well. So how would you think that manifests, and what have you seen in children where we might be missing the signs?
So when there's an emotional response, it's important to recognise that emotion is a choice. It's based on what we think about what's happening in the surrounding situation. So something happens, we put it through our past experience and we create some sort of thought about what's happening, and then we'll add emotion to it, and that will drive and shape our behaviour. And it's the emotion that we choose to add to it that will have our behavioural state be either something where we can act and respond, or we'll be reactive. And often people who, young people, can be very reactive at times, and that's different over different ages for different reasons. So I think it's very important to help people understand that because emotion's a choice, what are they choosing? Why are they choosing that emotion in that situation? Let's like kind of backtrack from there, and what's been happening for them that has them go to that choice. So it's a result of the environment, what they're influenced by, what they've been around, what's happened to them. And all those things are kind of sitting in the background. It doesn't have to be anything major. It can just be something that's happened which doesn't seem necessarily particularly consequential to the parents or the carers. And yet, there's something in that situation that hasn't been processed fully by the child. And therefore, in wanting to express something, often they'll go to emotion.
It seems quite complicated. And I know adults, including myself, who still react and have inappropriate emotional attachments to situations. So
for sure.
As children, though, I mean, it's so important that their needs are addressed. So let's look at the developmental stages. My first encounter with Maslow's hierarchy of needs was understanding what underpins our security and those sorts of things. How do we apply that to raising children from zero?
It needs to be said, I'm not an expert in this field, but I've read a lot, heard a lot, and intuited a lot, I suppose you could say. It's kind of a natural thing that when babies are first born, they need unconditional love, nurturing, support, and a safe environment. It goes without saying, but actually that's true for everyone, in fact, but particularly so for babies, clearly because they are so vulnerable. If you've heard of somebody called Nathan Walsh, I think his name is. He was working, I think he's still working at the Otago Central University. I remember him talking about early childhood and the importance of the first 1,000 days from conception, which means it takes you up to about 2.5, and the importance of the environment around that child, and that they can actually bond very well with what he called a monad. So in other words, one person, it doesn't have to be the same person all the time, but they need that one-on-one. That's extremely important. And that was really interesting for me, because often we think that they need two parents around, which indeed they do. Obviously, that's helpful, but they need the care and the attention of one person. So if their needs are met, whether it's hunger, love, connection, touch, whatever it might be, then it helps them set up from the baseline that real sense of security. I'm loved, I'm adored, it's unconditional, my needs are met, I'm connecting with the people around me. And that sets up a really, really healthy base for further development.
So from a developmental perspective, if they have all their needs met, then what's the transition like into that next phase?
I might just backtrack a little, because something really important that needs to be said is that, bearing in mind it's from conception, they will be taking on what the mother is taking on, because it's a closed system. It's one system, obviously. Whatever's happening for the mum is happening for the baby. And again, once they're born, I was just talking about the ideal situation. How many babies are born into an ideal situation? Suffice it to say, not very many, I would say, in what's a true supportive parenting situation. So bearing in mind this would be a healthy track. We are all very influenced by those who are around us, even from the get-go. As soon as a baby's born, they already are influenced, but as soon as a baby's born, they're going to be hugely influenced by who is immediately around them. So whether that's one parent, two parent, foster parent, a broader range of people around them, they're going to be highly influenced by that. So the environment they are born into is incredibly important. And that it carries on from when they're born, so like, you know, from conception, but when they're born to around the age of, it was originally 7, I would say it's probably more 5 now. It's called programming in a certain model I'm thinking of, but it's also, we're looking around and learning through the people around us. And you've had kids, Kim, and anybody who's had kids will know that kids don't do as they're told, they do what they see us doing. And therein lies the problem. How often do we do things unconsciously without any presence that they are picking up on, and they're going, well, I'm seeing you do it, so I'll do it. And, you know, that again can shape very differently how they navigate themselves through that 0 to 5 years old, from being, you know, nurtured and loved and everything else. Obviously, safety is important because they're learning to walk and do all those other things. And then it's who they're surrounded by. And I often use the example of, we need to trust our children more, because we're very intuitive from the get-go. We all are. We carry on being, but unfortunately, sometimes that gets a bit shut down for various reasons. But children particularly are very connected to, I'm going to say, energy, vibration, if you like. And therefore, in a certain situation, if you're surrounded by adult friends, family even, and you're, or somebody has encouraged them to go up to a certain member of the family and they don't want to, then you need to honor that, because they're picking up on something which is very uncomfortable for them. They can't verbalize it, but there's something they don't like about the vibration of that person. They might to you seem like a really good person, but there's something about the person that the child is going, I don't want to go anywhere near it. So I think to be honoring of that, rather than, you know, people say they need to socialize them, it's often the way that they're making their own choices, and that could be a good thing.
Socializing means different things to different people too, because we all have our own personality. And some children who can't express that personality in the early days may feel quite introverted or fearful around interactions with people, particularly that they don't know. I mean, I've had dogs that didn't trust family members, and it made me think differently about what that person's energy may be sending off.
For sure. It's about allowing them. I mean, it's like anything. You place them in a situation where they have access to that, but allow them to choose. So you're not forcing them to do anything. They're naturally migrating or navigating to somewhere, someone that they feel okay with. And that could be the most unlikely person. That's what's so interesting about it.
This has come up time and time again with quite a few people in my podcast, and it's that whole societal expectation we have of feeling like if our children don't model certain types of behaviour, we take it upon ourselves to feel embarrassed or ashamed. I don't know where that came from, but how do we actually tackle that as a society?
Well, I think we need to kind of shift our perspective slightly and say it's not necessarily wrong. You know, we're individual, and we're shaping our individuality from the get go. So I think it comes back to somewhere along here, Kim, is judgment and comparison. What are we comparing our child to, and why? Because we all develop differently. You know, some kids seem to be really slow, and then they go, you know, they develop really quickly from there, whether it's physically, mentally, intellectually, whatever you care to call it. And I think, you know, the comparison is probably what gets in the way of us parenting naturally. There's so much to be said for that sense we have as parents, is sensing what that child needs for them. Like, you might have 3 kids, 5 kids, whatever it might be, but they're all very different. You would not do the same thing for each of those children. If you do try and do that, then it could go badly at some point, because they're going to react to it rather than respond to it. So the first child might respond very differently to the third child, for example. So if we can move away from the comparison and just let them unfold and develop naturally, for me that seems like the most supportive way ahead, while still encouraging them and making sure that there's nothing developmentally wrong with them, that they, you know, they're healthy humans in terms of physical, mental health, then I think the rest is more to do with, why aren't they thriving in this environment? Why aren't they thriving with that teacher, for example? Why aren't they thriving in that class or that school? Maybe there's more to it than meets the eye.
And that's something else we've explored here, is the environment that children learn in. But that's probably even more important at home than it is at school, because so much of your time is spent there 24/7 before you even embark on the outside world. How do we then create that environment as parents who don't really have the tools, the skills, or the understanding?
Great question. I think these days there's a lot of things out there that we can find some tools, we can educate ourselves, we can ask people. And it does come down, a large point again, to what's your natural sense, because generations ago, they would just follow the parent around, or they'd go and, you know, follow the father around, whoever it might be. So they're learning from us. And what appears to be the case is that a lot of, say, from adolescence onwards, we're talking about that today, but they don't have life skills. And often I think what we're learning at those years is life skills. We're watching dad in the garden, or mum in the garden, or mum going to work and dad doing the cooking, whatever it might be. We're watching this whole interaction and a whole kind of socialising going on at home as well. And you're still learning. It doesn't have to be formal learning. In fact, I think it's quite the opposite, and I'm all for that. It's much more experiential, and that's so important for that age group, is that they have access to things that they can play with, so that they get that kind of dexterity and they learn to walk, and they, you know, the things that they're supposed to do developmentally, but you can still do in very different ways. You know, taking them shopping and, you know, all those things that will be naturally part of growing up and allow them to be independent later in life.
Yeah.
It seems a lot of people just don't have that.
Yeah, it's true. And like, especially with cooking and cleaning and regardless of your gender or how you identify, these are life skills that you need to understand.
And they're learning as from what we're doing. So it's perfectly fine if they're watching you cleaning the toilet or, you know, mowing the lawn or something, as long as they're safe, obviously. But everything makes a difference because they're still picking up on it.
From the age of five, because I suppose five is the age they start going to school too.
Can be.
What developmental stage, you know, are we looking at next? Is it like 5 to 8, 5 to 10?
Well, when it was originally 0 to 7, then 7 to 14, I'd say now it's more 0 to 5 and say 5 to 10 or 12 for various reasons. But that area is more about role modelling. So much as we're learning through people from 0 to 5 or so, we're actually looking maybe outside the family group, depending on who's been our primary carer, to other people. But it's when we are looking for aspects of people, behavioural characteristics, those sorts of things. In other words, I see this person do that, I see that person do that, but I quite like what that person does and how they do it. So it's called role modelling, but we're looking to somebody that we aspire to be like, in whatever way that might be. So that could be mum, dad, it could be a sibling, it could be a teacher, it could be the next door neighbour, it could be anybody, it could be a cartoon character, it could be a book. Somebody in a book, you know, it could be anybody, but we all probably have had somebody like that, a grandparent, that we've just kind of gravitated towards because there's something about them, call it their character, their behaviour, the way we feel around them, perhaps, that has us go, actually, I really like that about you, and we want to spend more time with them.
Interesting. How can we support our children through that phase of development?
To me, it comes back down to allowing them to experience lots and lots of different environments, again, safely, and meeting different sorts of people and just observing who they engage with, what they engage with and how. Because like any of these stages, they can be very healthy and create, you know, a forward path, a positive forward path. And it can be the opposite as well. So you can imagine role modelling. If we're looking to somebody to aspire to be like, who we're choosing in that point can make a huge difference. Because if we suddenly really like the way that somebody does something, but it's not necessarily a good thing that they're doing, but that the child kind of gravitates towards that, that's not necessarily going to be a positive outcome. But we deal with that how we deal with it. Do you know what I mean? So there can be healthy role models, there can be unhealthy role models. They're still role models for some kids. So, I mean, who they're around. But I also feel that there needs to be that variety so they're not just introduced to only one type of person, one type of situation, one type of environment. And that kind of socializing, if you like, but that's come somewhat later. But place them in an environment where they can experiment with all those things and therefore be introduced and observe and interact with lots of different types of role models, because it doesn't have to be just one.
It's hard in this day and age to allow children to have autonomy. I remember as a child being able to go out all day. You know, we'd go hiking, we'd go to friends' places, we'd be out on a push bike all day without a phone, and our mother didn't even know where we were. We seemed to make it through all right. It's difficult to navigate that in the modern age, but what can we do in smaller ways to allow children to have that feeling of autonomy, particularly between 5 and 12?
Great question again. And I don't necessarily have a great answer for it, except that whatever we can do to help that child be as independent as possible from the get-go, understanding those boundaries and that they must trust their judgment, but we have to help them find that judgment, to me that sets up a really good platform for them to then go out and do something safely. And that comes from things like family values and also making sure that we're aligning our behaviour to our values. So we might say that we find honesty and, you know, respect and all those things really important, but we have to be role modelling those to our children at the same time, because then they understand that that's what's expected and required until they choose their own values. So for me, it's if you're able to set up that strong platform from the start, then you're giving them the ability to be sensible around different situations. Because I don't know about you, but it seems to be that what's been a result of the fear of people of what can happen to children, because we've seen it happen, unfortunately. It does happen. We know it happens. We know that not every adult, not every person is necessarily a safe person for that child. but we can't closet them away, we can't protect them, we can't cushion them, because then that creates a whole set of different problems and challenges for them and for us as well. But how can we help them to do it safely, in a way that supports them to explore life safely? And that also comes back to recognizing what they're feeling in their body, not just what they're thinking, because the body is giving us all sorts of signs of lack of safety way before our brain necessarily kicks in. In other words, do I feel okay in this situation? Do I feel okay with this person? Do I feel okay in this group of people? And that's really important as well. But sometimes that's overridden because we put such a value on the brain and intellect, whereas actually the body kind of is also very important. It's more important in many ways.
I remember with both my parents working, I was given a lot of responsibility as the eldest child of two. Mm. And we had to do chores, but we were given pocket money for that. Mm. A lot of children these days, they're getting money and not necessarily having a lot of responsibility. Mm. I mean, is that one way of teaching children independence and life skills at the same time without it being abusive?
It's interesting. I've been hearing recently a bit about children want a job, right? And it's actually very purposeful. So it's where we can learn about purpose, because a lot of what seems to me, some of the young people I speak to feel like they're kind of like directionless. But for me, that's like lack of purpose. And it's often because what have they done to actually get the pocket money in the first place? Like it's just, it shouldn't be I'm rewarding you for this, because that can set up other challenges. But it's part of, we live in a household, we all need to have certain jobs. And they can be from very young, you know, have purposeful toys, for example, you know, like a little sweeping brush and pan kind of thing. It's not child labour. It's more about encouraging them to, I'm doing this, Dad's doing that, we can all do this together, here's what you can do. And yeah, they're not going to do it great, are they? But they will learn that they're part of a family group, and the socialising part of that will help them to find their way through that in many different ways. So for me, it's, yes, I agree, it's having some sort of job or responsibility which is purposeful, and not just giving them something to do for the sake of it. It's actually purposeful, which helps, again, further on down the track. So all of what we're talking about today is setting up a really firm platform, a really healthy, as healthy as it can be, platform for that young person, that young human being, to make healthy choices for themselves later on down the track when we don't have any control over them. We don't anyway, but...
Funny that you mentioned that, because I'd love to discuss with you the next phase, which is going into the teenage years, the more risk-taking and setting them up for adolescence. So I think what you've done today is really given us an overview of how important that 0 to 12 is when you do have probably the most influence on your children. So I'd love to explore how we can increase that influence in relation to having them trust us, which I think is crucial, and then look at how we respond to some of that risk-taking behaviour in the next phase. Rowena, thank you.
Thank you, Kim. It's been a pleasure.
Rowena Hardy joining me in the studio. Rowena is the co-founder of Minds Aligned and has provided this information as general in nature based on her experience as a coach, counsellor and facilitator over decades. You should seek independent advice for any medical conditions from your local doctor or health professional. Next week on What We Teach Our Children, we'll meet one of the most inspirational 23-year-olds I've ever encountered. I discovered Mackenzie, or Macca, as she's known to her friends, in Outback Queensland, coordinating the preservation of fossils at the Age of Australian Dinosaurs Lab in Winton. It's a place she visited with her parents at the age of 9 and knew immediately that was what she wanted to do with her life. Mackenzie's story will reinforce how important it is to trust your children and their intuition. The support you provide could change their life story. This podcast is recorded in Launchpad Studios thanks to Split Spaces, a nest for new ideas.